This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. One tenet of many kindergarten classrooms is the golden rule: treat others the way you want to be treated. So how do we explain to kids why a police officer kneeled on the neck of George Floyd until he died? Conversations about race and racism are difficult for many adults with young people in their lives. But parents, educators, and others are seeking out ways to not just talk about race with kids, but also help them become anti-racist. Seyun Omitogun is a 7th grade English and language arts teacher at the Central Park School for Children in Durham. She has designed an anti-racist teaching curriculum for the school. Seyun, welcome to the State of Things.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Good to have you and Ingrid Chen McCarthy, who is the owner of a bakery called Bread Service in Greensboro. She is also the parent of two young children. Hello, Ingrid.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, let me stick with you for a minute. It's a pleasure to have you. You've got two kids. They're 2 and 5, as I understand, and already starting to talk with them about race and racism. What about your personal history has given you the tools to start these conversations?
Well, I was raised here in Greensboro. I was born in Taiwan with the rest of my immediate family, and we moved to the United States, to New Jersey, when I was 2. My dad worked in the textiles industry, so that brought us to North Carolina when I was 7, and that's when I was confronted with my first instances of overt racism and bullying as a child. It was the first time I had been made fun of for my appearance. And that was something that really impacted how I grew up here. So, you know, I had a great support system and everything, but I spent most of my childhood wanting to desperately run away from Greensboro, from the South, as fast as I could. And I did, for a while, but, we came back here in 2017, with my husband, Jeff, who was white, and, we had our first child. I became really hyper aware of, you know, how I wanted my kids to experience being here as a minority, living in the South, and what that means.
Well, I'm just curious, too, as you were experiencing that racism growing up in Greensboro, were your parents, could you talk with them about it? And what kind of conversations did you have at home?
Well, we didn't really, because it was a classic first generation immigrant story. My parents were just, you know, struggling to make it and struggling to survive. So, you know, we were essentially raised not to cause conflict, not to rock the boat. Let's just, you know, brush it off and move on and try and ignore it. And I don't blame my parents for, you know, that's how they knew to handle it at the time. But, you know, what I'm trying to do is to empower my children so that we don't just ignore it. We actually confront it, and then we can try and change it.
Well, I know one conversation you recently had with your 5-year-old was about what happened to George Floyd. What did that conversation sound like?
So, you know, we went to go attend a Black Lives Matter. It was a car processional, actually. It was like a COVID-safe car processional, so it was a protest. But I wanted to explain to her why we were a part of it. So I brought up George Floyd and what happened. And, you know, I explained to her, you know, police officers, most of the time they try and help, but sometimes that they can be really hurtful, and they, especially to Black people. And it just didn't make sense to her. We just got into this really sort of awkward conversation because, you know, for a kid, it doesn't make any sense. Like, why would somebody treat you differently because of the color of your skin? I get that. Like, logistically speaking, it doesn't make any sense. Rationally speaking, it makes no sense. So, you know, it's the struggle of trying to explain to my daughter about systemic racism and white supremacy, you know, trying to break down these really complex concepts into things that she can understand, you know. So I think I tried to sum it up by just, you know, agreeing with her. It doesn't make sense. It's not fair, you know, because, you know, it's hard for me to sort of understand that as well. But I just, you know, it's important for me that she knows that it's happening and that, right. This is why.
Well, the complexity of explaining why anybody would do that to anybody else, but then to try to explain that a whole nation that you're living in is founded on the principle of white supremacy, and we wouldn't be here today with the economic system that we have had that not been. I mean, trying to explain that, or whether or not you even, absolutely, whether or not you try to a five-year-old is mind-boggling. Shayun, let me talk with you, because I know you're working with an older subset of kids. Tell us about the anti-racist curriculum you created with your seventh grade English language arts classroom. I know it's got kind of two, first half and second half. So lay that out for us, will you?
Sure. So in my classroom, we learn an explicitly anti-racist curriculum. In quarter one, we start with culture, identity, and relationships. And so that's really we have a driving question, which is, what does our classroom, seventh grade classroom, need to create and sustain a healthy community? And so in that, we learn each other's stories. There's a writing project. The students learn about culture and identity within themselves, but also within the greater context and community. And then in quarter two, we read the narrative of the life of Frederick Douglass. So the first quarter is really essential in making sure that everybody feels safe and that they're empowered and they know they're brilliant in the space, so that we can really break down some of the really complex and hard to digest things that we know happened during the time of slavery. We really focus on Frederick Douglass's purpose in the second quarter as well, in driving home, like you said, we live in a country that was founded on racist principles, and Frederick Douglass's purpose as a writer and as a freed slave was to tell of the horrors that happened during slavery in the way that he could and other people couldn't. And so we talk about that in the second quarter.
Then talk about the second half of the year, because you sort of build that foundation, right? You create an identity which may counter a lot of what kids have already heard about the identity of black and brown people in America. Then that becomes the foundation for what you teach next. So what happens next?
Yes. So what happens next is, Ingrid kind of touched on it, a lot of the students in quarter two are like, well, slavery was a long time ago, so what about now? And so in quarter three, we read The Hate U Give, which is set in the present day, and it really covers more contemporary forms of systemic racism. And in that unit, we look at the civil rights movement, the Black Panthers, the guiding principles of Black Lives Matter movement in addition to reading the book. We break down how the United States got from the dehumanization of black people through the institution of slavery to where we are now. So police brutality and the protests that are happening and the formation of the Black Lives Matter movement. And then in quarter four, the students take all of the things that we've learned throughout the year to practice self-efficacy and really reflect on where they see themselves as agents of change and what type of movement and activism they would like to move along in their lives.
Now, your students are 12 years old. So what understanding do they have of racism coming in? And well, let's start there. Do you have a sense of how deep their understanding is when they come to you?
It's at various levels. I really liked what Ingrid said about it doesn't make sense, but it's real, because my students bring in a variety of different backgrounds and lived experiences. So I have some students of color who come in and they're like, racism is real and alive, and I know because it happens to me and my family every day, and this is what our neighborhood is like, and I can tell you. And then I have some students, a lot of white students who come in, and this is the first time that they've talked about race explicitly, sometimes with their family, but also in a classroom setting. So it's a variety of different perspectives and backgrounds that they bring into the space.
I wonder, do you get pushback? And, maybe you get it right there when you present it. Maybe when the kid goes home and talks to their parents about it, they bring something back from home. Have you encountered pushback, and how do you manage that?
I have gotten pushback, and it's really changed the way that I've approached my teaching. So my first year, I thought that it was really very important for us to do the work. So I went into it in second and third quarter without giving the families clear communication that this is what my classroom is about and this is what we're going to learn. In the second quarter, in my second year, I started off in the very first quarter
letting families know that this is what we're going to learn and this is how we do it. And so there is pushback from students who have trouble with their own processing, as well as families who don't really have the resources and the tools or haven't done the development themselves. But the way that I frame it is that it's a collaborative effort. And so I want to learn and grow with their student, and I want them to learn and grow with their student. And so we welcome them into the classroom to do the learning with us and to do that growth. And it's hard, but it's totally worth it when you see the outcomes.
Well, yeah, I guess that's what I want to get at, because that, I mean, it seems to me that's the juicy part, when you can actually have the conversation among people who have very different perceptions coming in. You know, conversation means to turn together. So what kind of turning takes place when that difficult together talk happens?
A lot of really amazing things. So in the third quarter, my students do a lot of Socratic seminars where we sit in a circle and they bring the book and prepare, and we talk about the different topics, because there's no way to really unpack everything that happens within the book. And to see the students be able to break down and draw connections between, like, the cycle of poverty that happens in some low-income neighborhoods, and how that is related to the fact that rights were taken away from people at the very beginning at the foundation of the United States. It's seventh graders who are talking about this. It's also really, really powerful throughout the unit. Sometimes I see changes within white students. So one specific example I can think of is, there was a white student who was having trouble understanding why it wasn't okay or why it could be problematic to have joy or to feel proud of their white heritage, so have white pride. And as a Black woman, that was something that I was not quite prepared to address in my classroom. And so before I could even find the words to address it, because I do call my students out and we do have that trusting relationship, several white students actually were like, well, actually, it's not to say that it's not okay to be proud of where you come from, like the country that you come from, but you have to remember that there's this long history of white privilege and white power that has been harmful and has created these systems. And so when you say that you're proud of your white heritage, then it can be perceived as this way. And that was students who said that. I didn't even have to save it. And so to see things like that happen in the classroom, it's so profound and it's amazing, and they really can do it.
Well, I guess it's never too late to start those conversations, and obviously showing those through lines in history has a powerful effect. And of course, those conversations can happen with adults as well. And by starting early, it could be especially important. This is Charlita Hatch, who's the author of the children's book, Black Boy Joy.
I think sometimes as parents, we think our kids are not aware. There are studies that show that kids start to identify their friends based off race as early as 30 months. And this is not because the kid is racist. It's because the kid has probably been surrounded by people who have the same complexion as them for, you know, the first 2 to 3 years of their life. So it's just a natural progression.
That was Charlita Hatch, the author of the children's book, Black Boy Joy. My guests are Seyun Omitogun, a seventh grade teacher from Central Park School for Children in Durham, and Ingrid Chen McCarthy, co-owner of Bread Service in Greensboro and a mother of two. Ingrid, how did you start the difficult, perhaps awkward conversation? We talked about the fact that you kind of began to have this conversation. How do you do it? How do you sort of open the subject with a five-year-old?
She's, I'm really grateful that my daughter is very inquisitive. So, you know, she sometimes will just have questions of her own, but oftentimes it just comes up really naturally. Like when we are reading a book or when we're, seeing something on a show or something, and, something will just come up. It'll just be an observation more than anything, you know, look at the color of their skin or look at a, you know, what does your skin color look like? Those types of things. But, and then sometimes it comes up when we when something actually happens, like with Black Lives Matter and with George Floyd. I felt like that was something that I actually wanted to intentionally bring up with her. So, you know, sometimes it comes up that way. But, you know, I'm having these conversations with my husband too. He's been doing a lot of work in the last couple of years to really confront his own white privilege and white fragility as well.
Well, tell me just a little bit about that. How did that come? Did that come up in your relationship, in your marriage?
Yeah. So we've been together for 10 years, and it wasn't something that ever really came up in the beginning. Like, he knew that I was, an activist, and that I tended to be, I've been a community organizer for a while. But that wasn't something that really came up in the beginning of our relationship. It started to come up more when we had kids, because that's something that we just needed to be aware of. And then especially when we moved back to the South, I actually remember specifically, this is a good example of a conversation that we had, but I specifically remember a conversation I had with him a couple of years ago, about 2 years ago, where I just, I was just so regular parenting conversation that you have, and you're just like, I want to figure out a way to talk to our kids about race and about the fact that they're mixed race and what that means, and I just wanted to start the conversation with my husband about, like, what is that going to look like? How are we going to talk to our kids about race? And his response to me at the time was, well, okay, but that sounds really exhausting, and I just don't want that to be like a dark cloud that hangs over us all the time. And I just had this moment of like, oh my gosh, like, he still hasn't confronted his own privilege, his own white privilege, And so I very gently explained to him, like, I don't get that choice. I don't get the choice of not thinking about that. Like, because of who I am, like, just existing in the world and being out there, just whatever, going to the post office or going into a restaurant or whatever, I get confronted with that. So I don't get the choice of just like putting it on a shelf. And so he's worked really hard in the last few years. He's done a lot of reading and a lot of research on his own, and started to really understand the claim, what his white privilege means to him and how he can use that to work on behalf of our family and our community.
But I think your story illustrates how important it is. Doing the work is one thing, but that starts when you have the courage to have the conversation, and then the work can begin. But Shayun, then that leads to the other question that I have for you, which is, these conversations about race and racism are heavy. How do you make sure your students are healthy and prepared for that conversation?
So that really starts at the very beginning of the year, and it boils down to the relationships with the family, because my students are only in my class when they're in my class, and life goes on outside of that. So if I have a relationship with the families and the families know what's happening in the classroom, they can support me and I can support their child, and we can all support each other. And so luckily my school has collaboration with the school counselor. So when we're doing the units, in the classroom, am very intentional to not normalize being okay with the things that we're talking about. So especially when we talk about slavery and we talk about systemic racism and police brutality, I tell them that it's not supposed to feel good and it's not supposed to sit okay, because these are people doing things to other people, but we can't sit in the not okay. We have to be agents of change, and we have to figure out what we can do if we don't think it's okay to make sure that it doesn't continue to happen. And so continuing to bring that up in the classroom, like, it's okay to not be okay, but it's not okay to not stay okay, encourages my students to seek out, like, they come talk to me after class, they talk to the counselor, they communicate with their parents who communicate with me, and in that we're able to support the individual needs of the student.
What about you? How do you stay healthy?
How do I stay healthy? I love to cook, and I love to exercise, and those things help my body feel well. I also have a really supportive administration, and so I can tell them sometimes when I need a break and if I have to step back. In my classroom, sometimes we take breaks during the unit, so some days we won't talk about explicitly the things that we're talking about, or there'll be a connection through music. So we watch music videos and we look at the lyrics of rappers and how they use their words as activism. And we watch music videos, inspirational speeches, different things like that to change the mood, so that it's not, as Inger talked about, a dark cloud, but it's something that we must address. But we also have to, we got to get away from it sometimes.
I'm talking with Sheyun Omitogun, a teacher at Central Park School for Children in Durham, and Ingrid Chen McCarthy, co-owner of Bread Service in Greensboro, mother of two. And we will continue our conversation about talking about race with children after this. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. In the vocabulary of activism, there's a difference between an ally and an accomplice. An ally stands in support of an underprivileged community. An accomplice takes steps to work with those communities against the oppressive systems. Adults, along with children in their lives, and if you've got a young child in your life, you're probably or maybe working toward helping their kids become accomplices against racism. And these conversations can have great benefits for the adults themselves. Let's hear from Charlita Hatch, who's the author of the children's book, Black Boy Joy.
Kids give you so much grace and they give you so much resilience. They are so resilient that by having the conversation with your children, it will actually give you the courage to have the conversations with your colleagues and other family members.
And that's Charlita Hatch, the author of Black Boy Joy. I'm here with Sheyun Omitogun, who is a teacher at Central Park School for Children in Durham and the designer of the school's anti-racist curriculum. Ingrid Chen is with me. Ingrid Chen McCarthy is the co-owner of the bakery Bread Service in Greensboro, a mother of two, with me as well. Sheyun, this summer, I know you got to create an anti-racist curriculum for the entire school. So that's K through eighth grade. How did you adapt your English language arts curriculum for classes like math and science?
So the curriculum really focuses on this different stages of positive identity development throughout all of the classrooms. And so if we can, as teachers and as a school community, empower our students and uplift their brilliance in all of the classrooms, they'll have confidence. We'll build community and we'll build culture. And so one way that you can do that in classes that are not ELA and social studies is by including the voices of other people. So bringing in mathematicians of color, bringing in the contributions of scientists of color, the histories of people who haven't traditionally been told are really the focus of the curriculum. And when you start by doing that, making the students feel as if they belong and they're brilliant in the school, then you can really address the anti-racist themes and have those difficult conversations.
And Ingrid, one of the ways in which things like white privilege build in and are reaffirmed is by leaving those voices out. So if you never hear those voices, you never hear from those people and other contributors, you make an assumption about you and your race and people who look like you. That builds privilege. And I wonder if there are how you are talking with your daughter about privilege.
Yeah, so, you know, one of the things that this touches on what Sheyun was saying as well is that one of the things that I'm trying to be really intentional about is making sure that we are raising her in diverse spaces and making sure that we're any of the media that she has, the books that we have in our house, the TV shows that we watch, the movies that we watch, you know, things like that, that there's good representation. So it's partially representation of who she is as an Asian American or as a mixed race child, and then also representation of people of color, black, brown, you know, Latinx individuals as well, just so that, you know, when she sees it out in the world, that it's not something that's bizarre or strange to her, that, you know, this is really normalized for her. And that I feel like I never, as a child, I never saw any of that growing up. Like, I had very, very, very few examples of Asians or Asian Americans in media that I could point to and be like, that's somebody who looks like me or that's representative of who I am. And I think that, you know, seeing more of that now, I think it's honestly really empowering for me as an adult to see it now. But I feel like, you know, making sure that my children get exposed to that, I think it empowers them as well. And it gives them the confidence to be able to move in the world confidently and exist confidently. And you know, if they get confronted with racist incidences or experiences, that it's not as traumatic, that it can be something that they can stand up to.
Sheyun, how can parents and guardians of your students support the anti-racist work that you're doing in the classroom?
Parents and guardians can talk with their kids at home, because I think that the conversations are so much more fruitful and meaningful when the development is happening together. So I said earlier, my classroom is only one of the six classes that my students take, and it's only one of the places that they go in their lives. So they need to be seeing these things and having these conversations everywhere so that it doesn't seem like it's out of the ordinary. And so if families are talking about it at home and they're having representation in their houses, that goes a long way.
Ingrid, I'm wondering about your conversations now. Your daughter's five. How do you expect those conversations to change over time as she gets older? What are you looking forward to?
Well, one of the things I'm looking forward to is being able to talk about some of what Sagan talked about, which is, you know, some of the historical background. I think that's going to really help to fill out her context, you know, just kind of explaining, like, this is why things are the way they are. Because, you know, we've started to kind of talk about some of those things, but a lot of those are bigger concepts than she's able to sort of understand. So, what we focus on right now is a lot about fairness and unfairness. And she has a little brother, like, she totally gets it if I explain to her, like, this is fair, this isn't fair. So when we explain to her in that context, I think that really makes sense now. But I am really looking forward to actually, like, talking to her more about, you know, things, not just like broader things, but things that are happening here in Greensboro specifically, such as redlining. Like, I'm really looking forward to being able to talk to her about the historical effects of redlining here in Greensboro and how that has actually created segregated neighborhoods, regardless of whether or not it's legal, you know, or there's a law about separate but equal. Like, it's all around us where we live, and it exists everywhere where we are. And, you know, so I feel like when she's old enough, and that should be here in the next couple of years, like, she's already asking questions and very inquisitive about things. So I'm thinking that I'll be able to talk to her about it in those broader concepts and kind of, you know, nationally, locally, historically, all these other things to fill in those gaps for her as well.
Great stuff. Thanks for sharing your work and your efforts with us today. Ingrid Chen McCarthy, co-owner of Bread Service in Greensboro, mother of two. Thank you, Ingrid.
Thank you so much.
And Sheyun Omitogun is a teacher at Central Park School for Children in Durham. Sheyun, thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
Well, books, movies, and the news can spark conversations about race between kids and adults. But what about the virtual children's theater? Suppose you had a virtual children's performance in theater that would tackle that subject head on. Kalia Davis is an artist, actor, and director of children's theater. She recently adapted and directed a play called A Kid's Play About Racism. The play streamed online at the Children's Theater of Charlotte early in August. Let's talk a little bit about this, about the play. Welcome to the show, Kalia.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Tell us a little bit about the adaptation. Where did it come from?
We adapted this play from Jelani Memory's book, A Kid's Book About Racism. And the idea came out of, unfortunately, the uprising of the Black Lives Matter movement in response to the horrific killings of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor and so many others. Theater for young audiences, like the Children's Theater of Charlotte, were looking for ways to step up and say we want to use our art as a catalyst for positive change. And so in partnership with them and many other theaters, it was actually incredible. So many theaters got together and decided to produce this work so that it can be an artistic form of activism.
And the book itself is a really simple version of the story. His story, his skin color is brown, he says, because his dad is black, his mom is white. Let's listen to a bit of the book read by Jelani.
I'm proud of who I am and the color of my skin, but because of my skin color, people aren't always nice to me. Sometimes I get called names. Other times, it's worse. The person doing it might not even realize that it hurts me a lot. And when they treat me that way, it makes me feel small. You see, some people believe that having different color skin means you aren't as good as others. That's called racism.
That was Jelani Memory reading from his book, A Kid's Book About Racism. I'm here with Kalia Davis, who adapted the book into a play called A Kid's Play About Racism. She's also the director. So tell us more then how you took that story and turned it into a play. Who are your characters?
So as everyone just heard, Jelani Memory himself read his own book aloud. And when I heard it on the YouTube link, I was like, this book already has so much life to it. It has to be a play. But as we all know, children are learning the different components to making a good story. And a good story has a main character, maybe some secondary characters. There's a hero's journey. So I wanted to, in my adaptation, take every word that Jelani Memory wrote in his book, but expand that world with the main character that our kids could identify with, and we could watch him go on a journey. So Jelani is our main character, but we made him a kid, and he is working through the complexities of racism, and he thinks, because he's a kid, he knows what it is, and he can make it simple, like the book says. But using his feelings and being in touch with his emotions, he realizes that maybe it is a bit more complicated than he thought it was. And we get to see that journey through the different emotions that he has.
And how did you do that? Because I know this show is really designed for kids 5 and older. So how did you make these big topics accessible for young people?
Honestly, I mean, we started with the book. Jelani Memory himself wrote this book for his children of that age, and he wanted to make sure that they knew who he was and his history and his whole self. So the book's language is very accessible for a young age, and I wanted to maintain that accessibility when I wrote out the play. We have moments of joy, moments of levity, some comedy, some silliness, because we also want to make sure that kids understand that racism doesn't have to always be so scary and big and traumatic and dramatic, but it can be something that is simple as long as you name it. And so we just took the accessibility of his own words, and we were able to use that to make the play.
So we've been talking about literature, we've been talking about school curriculum, various curricula, as well as conversations around the table. What opportunities do you think children's theater has for creating these deeper dialogues?
Children's theater is another opportunity for kids to explore their imaginations in a really creative way that does not create any sort of barriers of entry, right? So they are going to the theater, or they are turning on now a screen and they're watching theater on a screen. And they are able to either put themselves in that world like they might do with a book, or they can see the possibilities of more. There are infinite possibilities when you bring something to life in front of them. And of course, we know that all children learn and absorb concepts in different ways. So we want to give them a range of ways to engage with these topics, and theater is just another one of those mediums.
In your case, you were able to hire a whole cast and crew of people of color. So what strategic decisions did you make about casting to challenge people's perceptions about race and gender?
I wanted to make sure that we are honoring Jelani Memory himself. Jelani Memory identifies as a Black man who is mixed race. He has a Black dad and a white mom. So my actor who portrays him at a young age is also biracial. And then I thought, if it's his feelings, they would be a reflection of him in various forms. We have female-identifying actors, we have male-identifying actors, but something that I thought was really special that we could do is we could show the range of the Black experience through these different characters that are portraying different feelings. Unfortunately, too often, a Black man is seen as angry, violent, mean. We have rage because that is a part of who we are. We just have to learn how to control it. But I also have a Black male actor portraying love, and he also voices his dad. And I wanted children and adults to see a representation of a Black man showing nothing but love and compassion, because unfortunately, there just aren't enough images of that in our media today.
What are your hopes for this play? What do you hope people take away from it?
We hope that this is just the beginning. We want to be helpful in starting these conversations. We want to give you access. Also, with Theater for Young Audience, something that we really believe in is creating resources and materials that can help support those conversations that you're having. So our show has an active audience guide that has a bunch of activities for kids and their families to participate in, either together or alone, that can continue to keep the conversation going even after they've seen the show.
What kind of responses have you gotten so far?
I will be honest with you. I am so pleased. Every community has responded to it in their own way, but it has always been met with positivity. I will admit that there have been a couple of families that had some reticence to the fact that we have named racism right there in the title. But then when they gave the show a shot and they saw that we were coming at it from a loving perspective that honors the struggle that a lot of our Black and brown children face growing up in this nation, I believe that there was empathy and compassion as they were watching our show.
Kalia, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Kalia Davis is an artist, actor, and director, and you can find out more about the show at our website, stateofthings.org. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.